in the next four chapters, 36, 37, 38, and 39 of Isaiah, we have what is an essential historical record. Chapters 2 Kings, 18 onwards, are very, very similar to this chapter of Isaiah, except that they add one thing, namely that Hezekiah had sent gifts to the king of Assyria and stripped off the silver from all the places in Jerusalem and the temple in order to do that. Also, this chapter is recorded in 2 Chronicles 32, but in a substantially different way. The book of Chronicles tends to be more devotional than the book of Kings. And this particular chapter puts together the two incidents. There is the incident that we've read today, and a further incident which we will study next week. But 2 Chronicles treats them as one. Now, I suggest that you might at some point, like when you have a moment, to read, first of all, Isaiah 36, and as far onward as you feel you want to read. And then you turn your attention to 2 Kings 18, from verse 13, as far as you feel you'd like to read. And then 2 Chronicles 32, from the beginning of the chapter, in order that you may get a whole grasp of all that is said at this time. It's a bit like the Gospels. You need to read all three to get a full picture. But each chapter, of course, is complete in itself and able to speak to our hearts by the Spirit. Now, would you turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 18 and verses 21 and 22? If it's talking about prophets, spoken and speaking prophets in the days of Moses. If thou say in thine heart, how shall we know the word which the Lord hath not spoken? When a prophet speaketh in the name of the Lord, if the thing follow not, nor come to pass, that is the thing which the Lord has not spoken, but the prophet has spoken it presumptuously. Thou shalt not be afraid of him. And in Deuteronomy 13 at verse 1, not about something that doesn't come to pass, but about something that does come to pass. If there arise among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams and giveth thee a sign or a wonder, and the sign or a wonder come to pass, whereof he spake unto thee, saying, let us go after other gods which thou hast not known, and let us serve them. Thou shalt not hearken unto the words of that prophet, or that dreamer of dreams. For the Lord your God proveth you to know whether ye love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. So concerning the prophets from the days of Moses, there were two issues. if they spoke and the thing didn't come true, then they were to be disregarded. If they spoke, saying to the people, you must leave God and serve the gods of the idols, even if their prophecy and their sign and wonder came true, they were not to be believed. Now, in the earlier days of the scriptures, we have what are generally known as the speaking prophets, of whom Elijah and Elisha are two of the most famous, and we have the writing prophets, of whom Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel are the most famous. In those early days, the days of Elijah, right up to the days of Elijah and Elisha, there were what is known as the schools of the prophets. You remember, just when Elijah was about to be taken to heaven, that Elisha went round with him to each of the schools of the prophets in three different locations and said to them, don't you know that your master will be taken from you today? And Elisha said, yes, I know. So there were these schools of the prophets. My own view is that they were not training grounds for prophets. We speak in football terms that young men come through the academy and graduate to the first team. But there seems to be no example of anyone graduating from the schools of the prophets to be a prophet. It seems to me, therefore, but it is simply my view, that the schools of the prophets were places where prophets taught those who wished to listen very seriously, taught them all the facts of their faith, underlining all the doctrines and giving them all the history that they needed to know. Not everybody, of course, could leave home. Not everybody could come and give themselves full time, at least for a season, to learning. But it does seem that the schools of the prophets were those who were instructed by them. But you can see that when it comes to the writing prophets, for the most part, but indeed I'll show you one of the speaking prophets as well, we do have a problem when it comes to the writing prophets. Take Isaiah. He was prophesying of the Lord Jesus Christ 700 years and more before him. So how can people judge whether his prophecies come true? The very thing that was said to authenticate a prophet, that they could observe that his prophecies were coming true, how could they do that with the long-term prophecies of Isaiah and of Jeremiah and of Ezekiel? Clearly, something has to give. If you would now turn with me, we'll begin to spot what gives. But in this case, it'll be in the hands of a speaking, but an unnamed prophet in 1 Kings 13. You know the story, but I'll just underline the point. And I'm going to read to you a few verses from verse 1. And behold, there came a man of God out of Judah by the word of the Lord unto Bethel. And Jeroboam stood by the altar to burn incense. And he cried against the altar in the word of the Lord and said, O altar, altar, thus saith the Lord, behold, a child shall be born unto the house of David, Josiah by name, and upon thee shall he offer the priests of the high places that burn incense upon thee, and men's bones shall be burned upon thee. And he gave a sign that day, saying, this is the sign which the Lord hath spoken. Behold, the altar shall be rent, and the ashes that are upon it shall be poured out. And it came to pass, when King Jeroboam heard the saying of the man of God, which had cried against the altar in Bethel, that he put forth his hand from the altar, saying, lay hold on him. And his hand, which he put forth against him, dried up, so that he could not pull it in again to him. The altar also was rent, and the ashes poured out from the altar, according to the sign which the man of God had given by the word of the Lord. Now here you see the two elements of the prophesying of a prophet in one story. This unnamed prophet names Josiah. And Josiah came to the throne some 300 years after this prophecy. There was no way of telling at that time and in that place whether the thing was true or not. So there was another sign. And the prophet said what that sign was before the reason for its performance became apparent. He gave a sign that day saying, this is the sign which the Lord has spoken. Behold, the altar shall be rent, and the ashes that are upon it shall be poured out. Now, it might have been taken by those who were there that that would happen on the day that Josiah was involved. But no, Jeroboam puts forth his hand, and his hand is struck with leprosy, and he can't pull it in again to him. It's paralyzed. And at that time is fulfilled that sign, the altar shall be rent, and the ashes that are upon it shall be poured out. So here was a prophecy of something that was going to happen 300 years later. But for the proving of it, something that was going to happen only a few minutes beyond was also prophesied. And by seeing that the one nearer prophecy was fulfilled, they and subsequent generations might know for sure that the latter prophecies shall be fulfilled. And you can find in Jeremiah and in Ezekiel similar instances. Now, what I'm coming to is this, that as we approach these two chapters, three or four chapters of Isaiah, we come to what is mainly a historical record. But why, after 35 chapters of prophecy and more to follow, do we suddenly have this insertion? Some scholars think the editor did it, whoever the editor was. No reason to think why Isaiah didn't do it. But why are these things put here? And the answer is what we've seen. His prophecies are long term, but we need to be assured of a record of things that happened in his own time that guarantee that the people knew truly that he was a prophet. Now, he'd been prophesying all that time. He prophesied in four reigns, and the 14th year of the reign of Hezekiah is getting quite on. Isaiah prophesied for about 50 years. If he was 30 when he started, he'd be 80. If he was 20, he'd be 70. You can say it quickly and it doesn't mean much. But he prophesied for a long time. He was part of that generation, part of the scenery. And in those early years, there were undoubtedly prophecies that were fulfilled. But for the sake of the whole book, right in the center of this book, there are 66 chapters and we're hardly beyond 33. Right in the center of this book is the authentication of events that happened where he was called upon in contemporary history and prophesied accurately something that came to pass within weeks. So that's the reason that this chapter is here and the chapters that follow. And while we'll scarcely be dealing with the prophecy, it's so brief, we will be spending most of our time on the historical background. But I just wanted you to know that why the prophecies, two of them in chapter 37, are linked so powerfully with the historical record. It was to, the people should be assured that this prophet of Christ in years to come and the prophecies of his own day concerning the other nations, which might not all yet have come to pass, that they were sure and steadfast and genuinely from the Lord. So if you turn to Isaiah 36, we'll just work through it slowly. It's the 14th year of King Hezekiah. That's about 720 BC. There is some doubt because one or two of the kings reigned as co-regents with the previous monarch. The sons reigned with their fathers, either because their fathers were ill or to learn their trade. So we're not quite sure, for example, whether the 50th year of one of the earliest kings was the 50th year of his reign or whether it was the 50th year of till his co-regent took over, because he had some years that would come later. So the 14th year of King Hezekiah is about the year 710 BC. He did not mention Manasseh, King Hezekiah's successor, among those with whom he prophesied. Hezekiah was the last. Manasseh came to the throne in 697 BC. So it's getting towards the end of his ministry. Isaiah is well seasoned, well established as a prophet, trusted by the king, trusted by the nation. And what happened was this. As I say, Chronicles, 2 Chronicles 32, runs all the events of chapters 36 and 37. But Isaiah 36 and 2 Kings 18 take the two events as separate incidents, as we shall see. And the only real difference between 2 Kings 18 and Isaiah 36 is the fact that it speaks of the stripping of the temple in order to pay for the defense of the realm. So the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the defense cities of Judah and took them. It's worth looking at a map of the time, if you like, of the United Kingdom, that wouldn't matter, or the times immediately following. For we're reading that Sennacherib came up against all the defensed cities of Judah. Now, in those days, there was Israel. For many years, there'd been a king of Israel and a king of Judah. Israel had vanished off the scene. So the cities of Judah were not more than 30, 40, 50 miles away, and in some cases, much nearer. Not talking about the whole of Israel. Here was the massive king with this massive army attacking the defensed cities of Judah. And he takes them. We're told in verse 36, he takes them. Now, I want you to think what it was like. I don't know how I can stretch it in your imagination, but here is, if you imagine warfare in the olden days and its foot soldiers, and here is the Russia coming with all its troops, and they've surrounded Orford, they've surrounded Wickham Market, they're marching on Stratford St. Andrew, and here are you in Saxmundham, and you think, this massive army is getting close. They're going to be in our fields any moment. They're going to be in our wives any time. We're going to be killed in battle soon. They were that near to Jerusalem. So when he was that near to Jerusalem, King Sennacherib sent his trusted lieutenant, Rabshakeh, from Lachish to Jerusalem. Now, he was a very intelligent man. You would expect the representatives of Israel, Eliakim, over the house, Shebna, the scribe, and Joah, the recorder, to have been intelligent, able men. But here was an on-the-ground commander of obvious great ability, trusted by the greatest king in the world at that time. But what I'm really referring to is that he knew the Jewish language. He was quite as able to shout to the men on the wall in their language, as well as speaking Syrian. So the king of Assyria sent Rabshakeh from Lachish to Jerusalem. Now, Lachish, they'd obviously moved right the way round in a sort of pincer movement to surround Jerusalem, because Lachish is about 40 miles southwest of Jerusalem. So on his move round towards Lachish, at some point he gets to Lachish and besieges it, and from there sends Rabshakeh. He's made a strength. He's shown the strength of his army. He's conquered all the villages. He's moved round with the pincer movement. Now is the time to frighten King Hezekiah. And so he sends Rabshakeh. And Rabshakeh positions himself in a very prominent position, which has been vacated by the men of Jerusalem. He stood by the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the Fuller's Field. And you can read into Chronicles that earlier than that, Hezekiah cut off the water supply. Not good for him, of course, particularly, but so that the enemy didn't get any. And that's where this man stood, by the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the Fuller's Field. Now, it clearly was an ambassage. He was coming as an ambassador. So Hezekiah sent his representatives out to him. There, as you know, was the chief of the household and the scribe and the recorder. And they too declare that they know Syrian. So here are Jews who know Syrian, but an on-the-ground commander who knows the Jews' language. His name is not Jewish. He comes, it would seem, all the way from the capital of Assyria. He'd come all that way from Nineveh. So Rabshakeh speaks to them. And he speaks to them in their own language. Say ye now to Hezekiah, thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria. Now, this is dominant language, isn't it? They're being commanded. They're not his men to command, but he's commanding them as an enemy commander in a strong position to tell Hezekiah what he's saying. And he describes the man whom he represents as the great king and the king of Assyria, the greatest nation of that time. Not without warrant, of course. And he says, and he speaks out loud so that everybody can hear, whereas the scribe and the recorder and the man over the house would rather he spoke quietly to them in Syrian. But he shouts out loudly in the Jewish language. And he says, what confidence is this wherein thou trusted? Now again, it's going to become very interesting to think whether he actually had a letter from the king, Sennacherib, or whether he just knew in general what his master would want him to say. And I say that because this passage that now follows is so well reasoned that it's brilliant. But it's brilliant as a great insult and blasphemy to God. But it's brilliant reasoning. If you want to bring anybody to be frightened, if you want to turn the screws on anybody, you couldn't have done it in a better way. All this will, of course, show the bravery of Hezekiah and the bravery of Isaiah when it comes to their prophecy. So first of all, he says, what confidence is this in which you trust? You say, I've got the advisors, I've got the generals, and I've got the manpower. But if you say that, you haven't got that sort of power unless you're putting your trust in the king of Egypt. Well, if you trust in the king of Egypt, it's a broken reed. It's the staff of a broken reed. If you lean on it, it will collapse under you. It will go and pierce you. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, is a traitor and a letdown to all of those who trust in him. So he was. There was nothing wrong about what Rabshakeh was saying. Then he moves on. However, he says, he's going to move on in his argument. But if you say to me, we don't trust in Egypt at all, we trust in the Lord our God, then Rabshakeh makes 2 points. And the first of them is this. Is it not he, and you'll notice how much spy knowledge he has, is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah had taken away? Now, you know, of course, that at the beginning of his reign, he did destroy all the high places. But they were high places of no gods. They weren't the true God's high places. But you see, Rabshakeh takes this up. If you say to me, we trust in the Lord our God, is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah hath taken away? Well, is he going to defend you? He says, now I want you to give hostages. Because we don't trust you. We think you will turn immediately to Egypt. Therefore give pledges, hostages. I pray thee to my master, the king of Assyria. And this tremendous sarcasm. You were talking to me, he says, about how you've got strength for war. I'll give you 2,000 horses. I bet you haven't got enough people to put on. It's quite violent language, isn't it? Quite powerful language. I will give thee 2,000 horses if thou be able on thy part to set riders upon them. Quite happy to do that. Donate 2,000 horses, because I know you haven't got the troops. How then will you dismiss me, just a captain, one of the least captains, one of the least of my master's servants, in order to put your trust in Egypt? And then he has this killer and very wicked and very blasphemous punch. Do you think I've come up without the Lord? Do you think I've come up without the Lord himself having told me to come? Well, you heard no such thing, of course. And am I now come up without the Lord against this land to destroy it? God wants you destroyed. Undermining the faith. Those who doubt, those who wobble. The Lord said unto me, go up against this land and destroy it. Frightening language, powerful language. Then Eliakim and Shebna and Joah said, I pray thee, speak unto thy servants in the Syrian language, for we understand it. And speak not to us in the Jews' language, in the ears of the people that are on the wall. To which Rabshakeh says in the Jewish language, hath my master sent me to thy master and to thee to speak these words? Meaning, oh, you're only a few. The words are destined for the whole of your citizens. Hath he not sent me to those up there who are sitting on the wall? Before long they'll be so short of food and not able to go anywhere that they will sit upon the wall eating their own dung and drinking their own piss. Frightening language to the ordinary man on the wall or in the street. Then Rabshakeh stood and cried with a loud voice in the Jews' language, hear ye the words of the king of Assyria. Thus saith the king, let not Hezekiah deceive you. Now again, this is another intended nail in the coffin. Hezekiah is deceiving you. Let not Hezekiah deceive you. He shall not be able to deliver you. There they are on the wall. They're encircled by this army. They know all the rest of the troops are not many miles away. And he's saying, Hezekiah can't deceive you. Hezekiah, sorry, will try and deliver you, but he can't. He's deceiving you. Neither let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying the Lord will surely deliver us. This city shall not be delivered into the hand of the king of Syria. But don't take any notice of Hezekiah. This is what the king of Assyria says. Make an agreement with me by a present. Now, this argument at this stage is very undermining. He's now appealing to the men on the wall, and he's saying, what I want you to do is all bring me a present, that's the king, come out to me, leave your stations, and seeing that you've retired into the city, if you leave your station and go out round about unarmed, you can eat every one of his vine and every one of his tree, and everyone can drink of the waters of his own snag. You can come out, you can betray Jerusalem, you can go back to your farm, and you can live in peace there, we're all around you, till the time comes that we're going to take you away to Assyria. Until I come and take you away to a land like your own, a land of corn and wine, a land of bread and vineyards. So he's offering them the permanent goodness of their land over and against what clearly he thinks will be a temporary enjoyment of the goodness of the land round about Jerusalem. He's still appealing to the people on the wall, to the horror of Joab and Shebna and Hilkiah or Eliakim. He's still speaking to the men on the wall. Beware lest Hezekiah persuade you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. And then he says it again, but he says it in more detail. Have any of the gods of the nations delivered his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Well, we know they're no gods. And that's what Hezekiah will pray. And we'll look at it next week in chapter 37. Have any of the gods of the nations delivered his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arphad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim? These were people they were actually brought to take over the land of Israel, to repopulate Israel, and who became the ancestors of the Samaritans. The gods of Hamath and Arphad, the gods of Sepharvaim, these people were worshipping their own gods. And they sent a priest, you remember, to teach them the way of the Lord. And what they did in Samaria was that they worshipped their own gods, Arphad or Sepharvaim or whatever, as well as the God of Israel. And that's the mixed religion that came right down to the gods of Samaria in the time of Jesus. Who are they, goes on Abshakeh, among all the gods of these lands that have delivered their land out of my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand? Gee, you're going to be an exception. Well, they will be an exception. And the Lord is right. But you can see the undermining force it has on the men on the wall. However, they said nothing. There was just a solemn, sullen silence. But the king had said, whatever they say to you, just say nothing. Eliakim and Shebna and Joab put off their clothes, rent their clothes, and went to Hezekiah and told him the words of Rabshakeh. And when Hezekiah heard it, he rent his clothes, covered himself with ashcloth, and went into the house of the Lord. Hezekiah, in each of these two incidents, we're coming to the end of the first part, in each of these two incidents, went into the house of the Lord. We must always remember, when trouble assails us, not to neglect not only the Lord, but to be with his people in the house of the Lord. And then King Hezekiah sent Eliakim and Shebna, but not Joab, but he did send the elders of the priests with sackcloth to Isaiah. And they say to him, thus saith Hezekiah, this day is a day of trouble and of rebuke and of blasphemy. It's a trouble for us. The Lord is rebuking us, and the enemy is blaspheming our God. For the children have come to the birth, and there is not strength to bring forth. We've got an army, but we couldn't win. It may be the Lord thy God will hear the words of Rabshakeh, whom the king of Assyria has sent to reproach the living God. So they say to Isaiah, lift up thy prayer for the remnant of us that is left. And then we come to Isaiah's words, Isaiah's prophecy. It's a very brief one at this stage. The reason that in 2 Chronicles, both the incidents, both the parts of this whole story have been run into one, is that they did follow one after the other. But here there is just a brief prophecy for the whole situation. Isaiah said to them, thus shall ye say unto your master, thus saith the Lord, be not afraid of the words that thou hast heard. Now here you are. Remember the early kings, Asa and Abijah, Jehoshaphat, face to face with an army they've got 400,000 men, and there was 800,000 men coming against them. And Asa had 1,000,000 men against him, and they were head on, face to face. And here's Isaiah in this head on situation, able to say as a prophet, be not afraid of the words that thou hast heard. This example of Isaiah acting with an immediate answer for an immediately pressing incident is here in order to commend all the prophecies of much more long distant fulfillment. Thus shall ye say to your master, thus saith the Lord, be not afraid of the words that thou hast heard, wherewith the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. Behold, I will send a blast upon him, and he shall hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. And what happens is Rabshakeh returns and finds the king of Assyria, not in Lachish, but in another town about 20 miles away called Libna. And he heard say that the king of Ethiopia had come out to make war of him, which is just a rumor. So Isaiah's prophecy is immediately fulfilled. A longer prophecy is coming, the end of the story, when Sennacherib will actually be perished with his whole army. But not at this stage. It's just that Rabshakeh goes away, discovers his king besieging Libna, and then because he hears a rumor, it's only a rumor, concerning the king of Ethiopia, abandons all that he was doing at that time. Well, next week we'll carry on, but Rabshakeh turns around and goes back and reappears to the land that just because Sennacherib has disappeared for the time being, they mustn't think they're going to be free of all war. Sorry to labour the point so long, but I wanted you to understand that these four strongly historical chapters that are here are there to substantiate the long-distance prophecies of Isaiah by showing us that whenever he preached short-term prophecies, they immediately came true. Thank you.